Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure, in which we probably will once again solve all the major problems of the world.
Or at least talk about them.
Well, we've got the solutions, and nobody will listen to us.
Well, yeah, the solution to global warming is make the planet cooler. I should publish that.
Yeah. But then you'd get global cooling.
Oh, no. Well, the solution to that
is global warming.
Global warming.
There it is. You know, really, I love the change in nomenclature to do with global warming.
Yeah, it's climate change.
Yes. Like, of course.
Are you denying climate change? What?
You know,
do you believe that summer exists?
This is my point. When people talk about this, I said, look, if there's a push to lower our consumption of petroleum, and there has been for a long time,
yep,
and we do, in fact, lower our consumption of the petroleum, and notice that at the same time we're increasing our production of petroleum, if we come into a nice balance in the near future where we really don't need to import oil from the Middle East anymore.
Yep, it's getting close.
I think that would be in everybody's best interest.
Well, that's amazing. I think the same thing. I think.
And if you have to disguise it as fighting global warming to get the liberals to like it.
Yeah, that's fine with me, too.
Fine with me, bud. But I just think the idea of paying an awful lot of money to people who want to kill us.
It's a little silly.
And, you know, just disrupting everything that's. I mean, if let the Chinese pay them lots of money to kill them.
Maybe they'll want to kill the Chinese instead of us, then.
Undoubtedly, because there's obviously a pattern in the world. The more money we give
to them, the more they want to kill us.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
let the Chinese give them the money.
Right. Let the Chinese give them the money, because if they try to kill the Chinese probably will be less tolerant of that
right.
than we are.
They might not like it as much.
Right. That's
right.
What I said, less tolerant.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. So, you know, if global warming is the necessary excuse to get people who otherwise wouldn't take action to reduce the fact that we pay a lot of people who don't like us to give us oil, I'll go for that.
See, as from the economic perspective, which is where I like to be perceiving things.
Right.
The idea of putting artificial costs on things like carbon credits, really dumb.
Yeah.
Really, really, really dumb, and I can't say enough reallys there.
Yeah, because it's not like derivatives have ever gotten us in trouble.
No, no, never.
Artificial
never had,
derivatives?
We've never had great recessions on that sort of thing.
No.
No, if you put an artificial cost on something as a way of moving people away from it, mm-hmm. and there's no obvious and direct immediate ill effect of the thing you're trying to prevent, people will do it anyway.
Yep.
And the reality is that it will just make it more expensive to do that. There are other ways of doing this. This is important. One of the things that's caused us to be less reliant on petroleum isn't the effect on the atmosphere or global warming or climate change or any of that stuff. It's that it's gotten expensive.
You got it.
And let me do a little rewind here.
Which,
by the way, is a word that isn't probably going to be used too much in the future because there's nothing being wound.
No, we are still dialing telephones. So
rewind might still be on. Rewind the video, please.
Yes.
There's nothing being wound, but hey, we're going to do it.
We use a lot of archaic words that date to the Stone Age,
right.
So don't worry about it.
Okay, I'm going to go back to why we started using gasoline. It's a really silly thing that we're still using gasoline. Henry Ford said he wanted to make an internal combustion engine because he could do it cheap. External combustion is a lot more efficient. This is what we use in nuclear reactors. It's what we use in trains. It's what we use all over the place. Okay.
Well, they used to use it in trains.
Right. Well, to some extent, they still do. Some of them are still external combustion.
They're mostly big diesel engines.
Yeah, big, but okay. So internal combustion is not as efficient.
We use it in ships, though.
Right. Yes, and ships and basically very large engines, big
right.
power plants, that sort of thing.
Really, really big engines.
External combustion. Internal combustion is easier to carry around with you because you're not boiling yourself by standing next to it.
Mm.
It's part of a safety constraint
right.
thing. You know,
right.
every time I got in the car, I died because it was hot.
Well, it also takes a certain amount of time to get the water up to boiling.
Yeah, you got
to
get that whole thing going. And anybody that sat and watched a boiling pot trying to get it to boil.
Not boil while you're watching it. That's why they put steel all around steam engines.
Right.
So you can't see it coming
to a
boil.
That's why it goes so much faster.
Yes.
Okay.
Because
all right.
you're not watching it.
So Henry Ford says, we want to make a cheap vehicle that people can all afford, and what are we going to run it from?
And he made the Volkswagen.
Sort of. It was the people's car, so yeah, sort of.
The Volkswagen.
So he said, well, we got a lot of coal, but coal's kind of expensive because people use coal to heat their houses, and it's going to burn nasty,
and
smoky.
It's really hard to figure out how to get it into the tank.
Right, and it doesn't burn consistently.
Right.
We need something that burns more consistently.
Well, preferably liquid.
Right. Whoa, there's kerosene. But everybody's using kerosene. Kerosene's expensive. Kerosene is in lamps all over the place. It's being used in stoves. There's a lot of good things with kerosene.
Saturn rockets.
Well, they weren't using Saturn rockets yet.
Oh, but yeah. later on they used Saturn rockets.
Yeah, he looked ahead and said, they're going to use that. That's going to be too expensive.
A jet engine.
Right, yeah. Well, we can't use that. The jets are going to take up all the... No. So what he did is he said gasoline. Because gasoline was a byproduct of the industrial refining of kerosene. It was a leftover product. It was cheap. Nobody wanted it. They
and
were
it's
dumping it.
Volatile and it blows up and
right. And they were like, "What are we going to do with this stuff?
It's
stinky.
It off.
You can't do anything with it." So he said, "Well, I'm going to make an engine that runs on this cheap stuff."
By the way, originally it was white.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. So all of this together, this concept of we're going to use the cheapest thing possible to make our cars run. If you make that thing not cheap anymore, if you make that thing expensive, there's going to be another Henry Ford that goes, let's find something cheaper to run our cars.
Right. Hydrogen.
Right. Hydrogen or, you know, Tesla's come out with the battery concept, and there's some
lot
of inefficiencies going on there.
But that runs on taxes.
Yeah. Right now it's just run on subsidies. And,
yeah,
you know,
taxes.
He's making big bets with many, many billions of dollars that the technology increasing the capacity and length of life of a battery
of
is
a
going.
Tax.
Yeah. Yes. Of a tax.
Of
the taxes
tax credit.
Will continue to keep coming in for
right.
him to continue his products.
Actually, he burns tax credits.
Now, I've got to say, I really admire the guy. I think, and I love the concept of the Tesla car, because eventually we are going to have the technology in existence to allow us to do what he's talking about. And if he can keep the tax credits coming to him long enough, he's doing it in such a way that he might be the guy that comes up with,
right.
with the way to do it. So I'm excited about that. And I like the way he's going to space. I like the, you know, there's a lot of cool stuff going on there. So don't make it sound like I'm coming down too hard on him. But I'm coming back to petroleum. If you get petroleum expensive enough for long enough, people stop using so much of it.
Yes.
And if you look at the 1980s to now, the per capita usage in the United States of gasoline
mm-hmm.
is one half, even though more than twice as many of us have cars. So we're actually using more.
Mm-hmm.
That is the decline of that. It's actually, we've accelerated that.
But there is an issue there that you need to take in. We have twice as many cars, but we don't have twice as many people. And as a result, we now have in many families more cars than there are people,
right.
which means we don't drive them as much.
And in the past 3 years, our per capita usage of petroleum products has dropped
yes.
massively.
Wonderful.
So that we are now at a point where we're using less gasoline per person by
mm-hmm.
far, we're closer to the one third mark than the
right.
one half mark. And what that means is that the people in the Middle East are not very happy. We've been giving them lots of money. We're still giving them lots of money, but they see the end. It's coming.
This is the end.
And it wasn't due to tax subsidies. It wasn't due to carbon credits and
right.
artificial
mm-hmm.
costs coming in. It was due to the fact that enough people needed it. The reason why petroleum prices went up, when we are producing more petroleum today than we ever had in the history of the planet,
mm-hmm.
and the prices of petroleum versus 10 years ago are 10 times as high.
And mostly because of China.
China and India, they mm-hmm. want cars.
Why? They just bicycles.
Bicycle and walk around and carry
right.
things on their back. I don't
right.
know what.
On their heads.
On their heads, yes.
Yeah.
They want cars. Well, The fact that they want cars means the demand for the stuff goes up, which means, wait a minute, we're talking economics. Demand, price follows demand. Whoa, it's amazing.
It's the law of supply and demand.
Right. So what we're talking about here is if you input
grasshopper
artificial inefficiencies into the market, all you're doing is making the market more inefficient. You're not promoting your cause.
Right.
You're making things more difficult.
Well, you know, I was explaining something to a environmentally sensitive person.
What does that mean, that they breathe oxygen?
Well, they're a person
who is legitimately
concerned about the environment.
Oh, you mean concerned. So they're sensitive as in they might get their feelings hurt, not that they would die from lack of oxygen.
Well, they might get their feelings hurt. Mostly they're concerned about the fact that
environmentally sensitive.
We are quite capable. Well, the Chinese aren't particularly environmentally sensitive.
Well, they are. They just ignore it a lot. Well,
they die from
emphysema and
oxygen
things.
Masks in Beijing and so on. Anyway, and I pointed out something that we were in a house that had a tremendous amount of wood in it. And I said, you look at this house and you said, what do you see? He said, a lot of trees were cut down, obviously. And he said, yeah. And I said, carbon sink. And he said, what? And I said, young trees growing really, really fast. And by the way, there are more trees in the United States today than there were when
Christopher Columbus, yes.
Because they're smaller trees and they're growing fast. They suck a lot of carbon out of the air and make it into wood.
Yep.
And then if we take the wood from those trees, we cut the trees down so that young trees can grow again, and we take that wood and we put it in houses and we seal it where it doesn't decay.
So it's not releasing that carbon back out.
We are sequestering carbon in our houses. And I said, now all those people who have brick houses, you should be mad at them.
Yeah, that's not,
because
that's
that,
not
they
a
have
carbon
to burn
sink.
Gas and so on.
Shameful.
To cook the bricks. What you need to have is more frame houses. I said, you guys want to get excited about something? Get excited about more frame houses, because those are carbon sinks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, we need also, if you think about limestone buildings.
Well, that's a lot longer.
It's a long sink. That's calcium carbonate, and that carbonate is the whole thing
but
about
that,
the carbon.
That was the last time around it got hot.
Yeah, we had a big sink, and we called it the ocean, and a lot of things were growing. And
of course, there's a lot of that going on right now.
If you make the oceans warm, you get an explosion of life. Things that weren't capable of living before are. But as well, things that were more capable of living in cold environments die.
Right.
But we'll probably have a lot more life than in the ocean than we used to. So if you think about the fish problems, all we have to do is increase global warming a bit, and we will have a lot more fish, and people will be very happy.
We'll have different kind of fish, though.
Yeah, well, we'll figure out how to eat those.
Right. Well, anyway, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, believe it or not. We talk about things to do with the economy. Telephone number's in here if you're in East Bell County, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And that's presuming today is May 17th, Saturday.
It is, actually, in my mind, it is.
Well, but, you know, if it's not May 17th where you are, don't bother calling because there's a time warp between us. Hey, let's talk about the stock market just a second. I said I wanted to
talk
about
that.
Something, okay?
Yes, it's good.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed up to a new record early in the week and then promptly slid back down a little bit again. And as a result, for the week, the Dow was off about 0.5%. The S&P 500 was off 0.03%.
What was it off?
Off from where it started.
It was off of it?
It was down.
Well, and when is it not off of it? If it's up, then it's off of it as well.
Now, if it was above it, it's not off of it, really. It's on it.
It's on it, though it's not
on
it anymore.
It's off its highs, okay?
Okay, these words are very confusing.
Now, here's something, though. You know, that's all really nice, and we talk about 1 week and all that kind of stuff. Here's something that if you're watching your own portfolio, you probably ought to be aware of, and you ought to be thinking about at this point, lest you get upset about something you shouldn't get upset about. Year-to-date. So you look at your year-to-date performance and you say, man, that's not all that good. And believe me, when we do reviews, we have people look at it and they go, oh, well, what are you doing? Year-to-date, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 0.5%. The S&P 500 is up a whopping 1.6%, which is about the same as its dividend yield for year-to-date, which we're coming in on the half-year point before too long. So just one of those things to be aware of is if your portfolio has not done particularly well this year, it's not because somebody's doing a bad job. It's because the markets have not done particularly well this year. Now, you go, yeah, but, you know, like the 12-month return. good, yes. Yeah, S&P 500 is up like almost 13%.
Very nice return, yes.
The Dow is up 7.4. But I'm going to tell you, that although that's going to improve a little bit, not because we get any better returns. If we get no better returns, what's going to happen is we had a couple of dips last year, and we're going to go through them.
Right. Even if we stay flat, right, we go forward a little bit, and we go 12 months back because it was lower. It looks like we've had a better return.
And it's one of the things that I would, if you want a little bit of wisdom from a guy that's been at this a long time.
Who's that?
Me.
Oh, okay.
Before you decide that your particular, for as the guy was talking about last hour, his 401k or his, or your broker or your breaker or your advisor or whatever you're working with,
circuit breakers,
has done a particularly good job, look at the time period that you've been with this person or with this 401k and whatever, and look how the stock market, now a lot of people don't know how to look at that, but this is a point. If the stock market did really, really well while you were with a given person or a given investment of something, and your investment did really, really well, the investment or the advisor may have had nothing to do with it. If the market,
except for maybe convincing you not to leave,
right? Well, if it's doing well, people don't generally don't leave.
That's
if,
true.
You know, and I had it. We had a guy who packed up and went somewhere else not too long ago, and I remember I told him, "You came in the door as the asset back in 2000." As the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average hit record highs, they are well below where they were back then at this point.
If you count inflation in.
But I'm talking about the point where he left. And he said, yeah, but, you know, I've talked to people who've been with other guys for the past several years, and they've done really well. And I said, so have you for the past several years. Yeah, but I haven't done well from the time I started. Well, that's okay. He went on, and I'm sure he's enjoying himself now wherever he is. But this is the point. Moving around from one person to another person because the market is going up and down is one of those things that shows up in the surveys, and I've been reading a lot of academic surveys recently, studies, as being very destructive to the investor's value.
Yeah, I think
in a portfolio.
The reason why you should leave or stay with an advisor, whether that's a fiduciary or not, is if they're designing the portfolio around you, if they're taking into account your long-term goals,
then they should leave.
Well, wait a minute.
No.
No, I mean, it's something, if they say we're going to invest it, and the reason why is because it's a dividend paying, then you have to say, well, do you know why I have my money with you? Because it might be appropriate, but this is one of the issues, and this is something I've seen recently. I've seen quite a lot recently. A lot of people have these large dividend-paying stocks in their portfolio.
Mm.
And if I'm looking around at things that are overpriced right now, it's large-cap value. They're a bit overpriced. And people are moving there because it's conservative, according to them.
Mm.
And because they pay large dividends, according to them. And that long-term, these dividend-paying things are great, except that this is the area, because it's being recommended by so many people,
it's
overpriced.
Right. There's kind of a rule here. It's not absolute, but it's pretty close. If whoever you're working with is selling you what you want,
right,
you are overpaying for it.
Yeah, if you already know what you want, then they just now, selling it to you means you probably could have gotten it.
Right. If they're coming to you and saying, here's what I think you ought to get into, and you look at it and say, whoa, that's really been going down. I don't think I want any of that. You're probably working with the right guy.
Right. Or if they say, we want to have some that's going up right now and some that's going down right now. And you go, huh? That's probably the right guy or gal, too, because we're talking about science then instead of just, well, this feels good because it's going up. Because the reason, if you're getting into something because it's going up, then the reason to get out is it's going down. And if you think about that for a second, that is buy high, sell low.
Vanguard published a paper recently on advisors' value to an investor. And it isn't perfect. It isn't all comprehensive. But it does point out some very, very, very valuable things. Basically, if you've got a couple of advisors who are both doing pretty much, this, let's just say, and I'm going to say this very carefully here, but let's say you have two different investment advisors, and I say that investment advisors, not financial advisors. They're both trying to follow modern portfolio theory, which is the theory, it's kind of like germ theory to do with medicine, it's probably a good idea to follow it. And the difference that one on average, now this is not absolute, but it's pretty close. One of them, by very carefully choosing correct funds and mixing indexes in some places and active management in another, and they really put a lot of effort in it, probably will get you somewhere between 0.5% and 1% a year over a long period of time, more return than another one. That's the only difference. And 0.5% a year in an up and down, bouncing around market feels like it's not even there. You have to actually see it over a long period of time to see it work out. Now, so what is the difference between advisor X and advisor Y? Guy who comes along and says, hey, I'm going to do a wonderful thing for you.
I can tell you right away. They're two different letters.
You got it.
That's an easy one.
But there are two major differences that the Vanguard study came out with. One of them is expenses. You look at the total expenses. You look at the expense of the funds and the commissions and the fees and everything else on one advisor. And if he's doing exactly as good a job as another one and somebody is charging you 2%, and I understand that's a fairly common amount to be charged, you probably can't see it all, but 2% is pretty normal. If somebody is charging you 2% and you're in long stocks over the long period of time after inflation, get about 6.4% on average over a long period of time. If somebody's charging you 2%, they're charging you 1/3 of your total stock return. That's going to have a profound effect over a long period of time.
I could very conceivably
now,
so, yeah.
Here's the other place where they can have a great deal of effect. Are they actually following good science in building your portfolio? Are they just grabbing whatever's hot and whatever gives them the highest commission? And those are the Vanguard study came to the conclusion that those are your differences right there. It is possible for an advisor who is really, really good at picking the right investments to improve your performance by maybe 0.5% a year, maybe 1% under exceptional circumstances. And I don't care whether it's a hedge fund or anything else. But if they're charging you more than that to do it, you're coming out behind the power curve. And I know that sounds extreme. You know, I'll tell you right now, a lot of our clients we charge 1% to, okay? And I think we probably produce about that same amount of excess return. Now, that sounds like, well, okay, then
they're
getting
nothing.
Why are
they paying you for?
Because when they're done, they get the full normal return of the asset classes they're in, which is as good as it gets in the real world, folks. If you've got somebody that promises to beat the market, let me tell you, if you're not a billionaire.
Wait a minute. If somebody promises to beat the market, you should run away. Very quickly. There's a problem there. A massive problem.
But it's very simple. If you're not a multibillionaire, what the heck is this guy talking to you for?
Yeah, if he could beat the market.
If he could beat the market, by the way, then he should be managing a mutual fund. There are mutual fund managers, top-of-the-line mutual fund managers, who earn 7 figures a year and never have to deal with people like you and me.
Correct.
They don't talk to clients. They get treated like they are prima donnas because they are. They manage funds. They pick stocks. Some of you are old enough to remember Peter Lynch and some of the better managers that have been out there over the years.
John Templeton.
These guys become billionaires. And if somebody is talking to you and you've got $100,000 or you've got $50,000 or you've got $500,000 and they say we can beat the market.
If you're so smart, why ain't you rich?
You know, of course, now there's different areas of the market. The fact that they can beat the S&P 500 over a long period of time doesn't mean that they're beating the market because they're just using a different set of asset classes.
They're using different markets.
Anyway, enough wisdom for the day. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. The telephone number is in here if you'd like to speak with us. It's 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we need to play some comicals.
Commercials.
Yeah, okay. So this is all good stuff. And so listen to it. We'll be back on the other side. We'll be right back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And you were listening to the St. Thomas Episcopal High School marching bagpipe and drum band.
Well, I think that was from what year, though? 1999, something like that.
Yeah, something like that. But when they were the world champions. Maybe they still are. I don't know. I just haven't been able to get any good CDs since this one. And this one is hard to hang on to. Telephone number's in here at the Personal Wealth Coach. If this is Saturday, May 17th, actually, the telephone numbers are probably the same. 773-1400 if you're in Eastvale County, or
1-866-597-1400
anywhere else. Caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. I know everybody's looking to make as much money as they can. That's understandable. And I think I may have come up with a way that everybody can make some money.
Really?
Right.
Does it involve printing presses?
I was just going to say, don't be printing it.
Oh, well, that's the only effective way to make money.
I called you back a couple of months ago about on Rush Limbaugh's program. He advocates personal responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I could not understand why he would take sponsors that are basically these tax companies that will help get you out of your tax problem,
mm-hmm.
Get you a settlement for pennies on the dollar.
Right.
And he advertises one, for example, that somebody, I think it was a construction company or something, owed $380,000 in taxes. They settled for less than $30,000.
Sure.
So they pocketed $350,000.
Actually, I don't think they did.
Of course, I'm sure they paid the tax company something, too, but they still skate on a lot of their taxes. I listen to the Austin channels a lot, and this is like more and more of these companies are cropping up, and there's one called Tax Tiger, or Tiger Tax.
Mm-hmm.
They say there's 64,000 people in Austin that's either under audit or in collections or whatnot with the IRS, and they will get you out of your tax problems for an average of $500. Well, now, there's been years I've paid, my regular salary and my stock dealings, I've paid over $50,000 a year in taxes.
That means that you're not average. You are not average.
You're definitely, and you probably would never use Tax Tiger.
But the point is, if I want to make a lot of money or somebody wants to make a lot of money, then I'd say quit paying your taxes.
I don't think that works.
Don't pay for 5 or 6, 7, 8, 10 years.
Well,
go to one of these companies and get you a $500 settlement, and you've just made you a bunch of money.
Well, see, there's a difference here. And one of the things, if you intentionally don't pay your taxes rather than just mess up a bit,
then they
give you free room and board. They provide you with a living wage, basically. You get paid in food and you get your own. It's very
you just, by the way, blew your chances of doing what you just said, because you said it on public that you wanted to do it intentionally.
Right. If you go out and
I'd be like Geithner, though. I claim, that it was an oversight.
He paid his taxes.
Yeah, he wound up paying
more
than
the taxes plus penalties.
Right. But the point I was really going to get at is that, is there any way that we can put a stop or a stop we put one to the IRS to accept settlements? If you owe taxes, pay them.
Okay,
pay through the nose.
Let me explain what those false advertisements, and they are false advertising, are all about. Let's just say that Tiger Tax, you go to Tiger Tax and say the IRS is on me and they are hammering me and I'm getting calls and it's driving me nuts. And you look at this family and you find out that they have no money. They're broke. One of them had lost their job. They don't have any savings. They don't have any property of any significance. You go to the IRS and said, you can't get what these services do. They go to the IRS and they know what they're doing. They get to hold of the right person and they say, this is a turnip.
There is no blood in this turnip.
And so I tell you what, you're not going to get anything from these folks if you just keep harassing them. We can cut your losses here. They can pay us $500 and you $500. And that way you stop having to try to chase these people down. They stop being harassed and feel better about it. And since all they have into their name is $500, that's all you're going to get anyway. Because if they actually go to court, which isn't going to happen because they can't afford an attorney, but if they actually ever did get into a court, a jury or a judge would look at it and say, no, these people, they're
going to have any money.
They don't have any money. You can't get any money. And that's
people like that are probably going to be low wage earners or medium wage earners.
They're right.
Going to be, their taxes are going to be deducted. It's not like they're not getting their whole.
But then what I'm saying is,
and then not paying
right.
their taxes.
And this is the point: when you have people who are broke, they don't pay their taxes not because they decided not to pay their taxes, but because they ran in. You know, they didn't pay enough taxes one year. They lost their job.
Here's an example. I can give you a quick one.
Right.
Somebody that is just started in a construction job, and this is an example. I've seen it happen dozens of times. Just started a construction job. They're not very well educated. They're pretty good at construction. They're working for a while. They take another job with another place, so they're not at the same place anymore. And they at the end of the year, they file their taxes, and they don't realize, because either they weren't told or they really just didn't understand, that the first employer hired them as a contractor, and they were expected to withhold their own taxes. And they didn't know it, and they spent it, and they spent it on food and on beer and on cable and on every, you know, whatever else that they spent it on. But you can't sell that stuff back to get the money. So one of the things that the IRS will do in cases like that is they will say, any money you make in the future, we get part of that. They garnish wages.
But if their income is low enough, you can't. They aren't going to do that because, let's say the guy's married, he's got a couple of kids.
They'll starve to death.
You know, and they're in the poverty bracket already. There's just no way that the IRS can do that. Well,
yeah, it's true. We do. And this is absolutely the case.
That's what I'm actually tired of.
And it has more to do with ignorance and lack of education. Because if you look at the surveys that are done of American citizens, and this is across the board, almost any state, you'll find that the vast majority of people, like way up above 70%, believe it is a duty and an obligation to pay the full tax. Going to almost any other country, there are some exceptions. Switzerland is an exception. But almost any other country, and you find that they don't think it's an obligation to pay their taxes. They try to find any way they can to not pay those taxes. We, and you, obviously, otherwise you wouldn't be bringing this up, believe it is important to pay our taxes.
Right.
Because we are the ones that vote on whether or not those taxes get spent. And the fact that we're voting on it means that we need to pay it.
Let me give you an example of this. You said construction company. He said that the advertisement was about a construction company. What's happened in the last several years to construction? It collapsed.
They spent all the money that they had new enterprises, and then failed.
In 2009, the construction industry just collapsed. And if the people had made the money in 2008, they made a lot more than they thought they were going to make in 2008, so they didn't set aside enough to pay taxes. 2009, they tried to stay in business by retaining people, and they ran completely out of money, and they're teetering on the edge of bankruptcy at this point. And the IRS says, you owe us $385,000. And if the IRS comes in, and they will come in, and they look around and they say, and the guy says, look, I don't have anything I can give you. You know, you can, if you want to have all this worthless stuff here that I'm not using to make things with that's worn out, you're welcome to it. And the IRS says, well, how much can you? In essence, it's a negotiation. And the IRS takes a look and says, yeah, you guys could probably pay us about $38,000 without destroying yourself. And the guy goes, yeah, we could pay about that much, but no more. Then the IRS says, okay, give us $38,000 and we'll call it a debt.
Now, if they did it intentionally, the IRS doesn't care about the negotiation process.
No,
people go
that.
To prison.
Yeah, and if it's and believe me, being a small business owner.
Just talk to Wesley Snipes about that one.
Over many, many years, I can tell you that there have been times when I did my quarterly withholding and I did everything I was supposed to do, and at the end of the year, I got a surge of income in, and I owed taxes, and I wound up spending money because I wasn't completely on top of the books and everything else because we got a downturn the following year, and I'm thinking I'm going to make it up at some time during the year. It doesn't happen. And I wound up owing a whole bunch of taxes I could not afford to pay. Now, I wound up paying every penny of those taxes plus penalty and interest because I wasn't facing bankruptcy. But I can also tell you that I have known people who have done the same thing, and every small business person I know of.
Oh, yeah. Every small business person that I have ever met has had to pay penalties on taxes,
and so,
because you can't know what you're going
to
make.
And they, when you run to the point when there's just nothing there to pay the IRS, believe me, I've called up the IRS and said, folks, I owe you this much money. There ain't no way in the world I can pay it. And you know what? We had a nice conversation on the telephone, and they called me back. We had more conversations on the telephone, and they said, okay, here's a program you fall under. You can pay it out over so many years. And I say, fine, can I sign up for that? And they said, sure. And so they hit my bank draft. They bank drafted me. They hit my bank every month for a couple of years to pay my back taxes plus interest and penalty. And I paid it all.
And that interest and penalty keeps growing as it goes forward.
But I can also tell you that I could easily imagine a situation where things had gotten bad enough and enough out of control. And believe me, that does happen with...
And by the way, this was lots of years ago. Yeah. This isn't any time recently.
It's many, many years ago.
Yes, I'm thinking, I hope so.
Oh, no. When I was an independent stockbroker, it was boom and bust. But I always paid the taxes. And I always paid every debt. And I know guys in the construction business that I've talked to, some of them, like you, cut a deal with the IRS, and over a long period, some of them got out of the construction business, got a job, and paid half of their wages to the IRS for 10 years. Others stayed in the construction business. They owed the IRS money, and they said, look, if you take enough from us to pay the taxes, we're going to be bankrupt, and we'll have to lay off everybody. And the IRS looks around at the number of employees that they won't get taxes from if these guys lay everybody off, and said that'd be stupid.
Yeah, there's
so they cut a deal with them.
Last week we actually spoke a little bit about this concept. I used a safety net and a ladder on the net, and it was not such a good thing. And old Baldy across from me used a hospital bed and the economy in question. And during the Great Recession, the people involved in making sure we didn't have a depression were great. They got the economy into the hospital bed. They started the IV drip. They started the medication. They got all the things going properly, and they waited too long to get us out of the bed. But they prevented us from getting so sick that we really, really were in trouble.
But
the same thing is true here with the IRS when they're coming into these things. If they take as much as they need to take to get all the taxes back, then they will never get any taxes from these people in the future, because they'll be completely destitute. They won't be able to earn money at the level that they used to. So that has to come into the negotiating process. It has to.
And let me tell you, if you want to do something about this, and there is a flaw here.
A big one.
And that is the IRS is underfunded. And your congressman and mine has helped cut the funding to the IRS, because you don't like the IRS and I don't like the IRS.
I don't like the IRS.
It's very popular to cut their budget. And when you cut their budget, they wind up with fewer agents to do audits. And as a result, right now, the chances of being audited are the lowest they've been since the IRS has been audited.
Yeah, there's a massive backlog of people that they want to audit. And actually, there's a little bit of a economic fear here in my mind. If the IRS actually does get fully funded in the next couple of years, there may be a huge hit to the economy with all the backlog of audits those people.
No, you've got a statute of limitations of 3 years there, unless it's fraud.
Yeah, unless it's fraud.
Unless it's intentional, there's a three-year statute of limitations. But the point is that, very frankly, I think, and I realize this is a very unpopular position, the IRS is underfunded right now. It has an insufficient number of agents and an insufficient number of people and an insufficient amount of education. They're being starved. And as a result, there are people, I am confident at this point, who recognize they can tax evade and get away with it.
There is a study that just came out, and it had to do with the earned income tax credit. The Congressional Budget Office was part of the study. And they said that, Again, there is a law on the books that's supposed to prevent the fraud and the overpayment.
But it has to be enforced.
Right. And we overpaid the earned income tax credit again for the year 2013 by several billion dollars with a B. That's the sort of thing, exactly what you're talking about. The only way to prevent that is if there's enough agents on the payroll to go and look and say, do these people need that money? do they really deserve the money? They need to be able to look at the data and say, no, they don't, or yes, they do.
From a purely economic point of view, any money we could allocate more money in the budget to the IRS and lower the deficit. In other words, we can raise spending and lower the deficit
right.
by giving. Now, there's a point, obviously,
yeah,
beyond
you
which.
You spend about $100 million, and you could save several billion
yeah.
dollars.
And this is particularly powerful in the House of Representatives on the conservative side. They have consistently cut the IRS budget year after year after year. And obviously, the reason is the people who pay them campaign contributions don't want to get audited.
for some reason, I don't know why.
I think
this comes to a different subject, but it's connected, and it's something that I like to talk about. It is something
fair tax.
I think even if we don't use the fair tax, which I think is the likelihood of us doing that is almost nil. But if we did, I think it would be really great. If we do not simplify our tax code,
right.
then the concept of paying—I don't even know where to start. The code is so complex.
It is.
There are so many problems. If you and I don't know how much we owe, then an audit is going to say what their opinion is, and then it's a negotiated process. Every audit is a negotiation. That should not be the case. There should be.
As long as you brought it up. Can you clarify something for me? What is the difference, if any, between the fair tax, the flat tax, and the national sales tax?
Okay,
what are the differentiations there?
All right, the flat tax is an income tax.
We had one.
Yeah, well, Ronald Reagan had a three-tiered flat tax, and that was a fairly simple thing, but yeah. there's deductions and things that were still there. It basically said you make this much money, you pay this much tax. You make this much money, you pay this much tax. More and more deductions got added in, different things
More rates got put on.
Yeah, it's really confusing now. So that's the flat tax. The fair tax and the national sales tax, the fair tax is a form of a national sales tax. The fair tax says that if you spend anything that doesn't have to do with food, basic shelter, that sort of thing.
Or the production of income,
that's something that you're not going to resell, then you're going to pay a flat percentage on the purchase. And that would be at some point included in the price. So basically, what we have in an income tax from an economic perspective is a friction, a impediment to making money.
Yeah, and this is
if you make money, you have to pay taxes. What you would have in a fair tax or a sales tax is an impediment to spending money, which would mean you would save more, you would invest more.
But you'd spend less, which would slow the economy down.
Right. So both sides have friction. One, I think, is a little bit fairer, obviously, in that rich people spend more money. If they spend more money, if they buy more things, then they're paying more in taxes because they're buying more things. Poor people spend a much larger proportion of their income on food and on shelter. So the portion of their income that's taxed is the stuff that they buy for fun things, for other things besides just survival. And that makes sense to me.
Saying then that the fair tax is really a form of a sales tax?
Yeah, it's a national sales tax. That's
correct.
Exactly what it is. It's 23%.
Which is the average tax
rate.
It's
not the same as no matter what you make, whether it's $10 or $10 million, it's not like you pay 10%. You either pay
a
dollar
be a flat
or
tax.
You pay a million.
That's a flat tax. Right.
And the problem, of course, is that a person who is...
The flat tax you're saying... You have different categories. I'm saying there's only one category.
Correct.
Everybody pays 10.
That's the pure flat tax.
Yeah, and the problem, there's a lot of problems with the pure flat tax. It won't be 10%. It'd be like 23.
Well, no, I know. I'm just using 10% for it.
And so if you take a person who's barely making a living right now, feeding a couple of kids and their two or three jobs, minimum wage, and you just said, okay, we're going to take 23% out of your pay.
They wouldn't make it.
Their kids are starved.
Yeah. If you take somebody making $1 million, they have excess income beyond what they're using. So this is why.
Yeah, this will hurt them more. But still, they're using the same roads. They're using the same hospital. They're getting the benefits of the same national defense. They're getting the same everything that everybody else gets. It's just that because they make less.
If you take 23% out of their money, you get nothing.
Yeah, they won't
because
be able
to stop making money.
This is the thing here. Taxation as an ethical practice needs to only tax things that are not necessary to survival, which is why we have those weird deductions that we have in the tax code, because people are always debating on what's necessary for survival. If you have kids, it's necessary for them to be around, so you get a tax credit for the kids and so on and so forth. So the flat tax is a great idea if you could do it without shutting down the system. The fair tax is a great idea if you can do it without shutting down the system. But what we have in the middle here is this hodgepodge of taped together, stapled together weirdnesses.
The problem is, in order to go to a tax overhaul and you get rid of some of the big deductions.
Yeah, people are going to scream.
Like the mortgage interest deduction? You're just going to have people shrieking because the price of houses will drop. So there's a lot of it's a complicated area and certainly worth reading on. You can Google it and just get 10,000 tons of information in no time.
We're out of time. Thank you very much for the call. Very much appreciated. Good questions. If you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting. We do actually use conversations from listeners for the next programs, and we do answer questions off the air. We have voicemail waiting locally at
947-1111.
You can also reach us toll-free at the same voicemail at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Or you can go to thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, see our webpage, see our Made for Radio Faces, listen to podcasts, which I think you should be well medicated in advance. But if you made it through this hour, then you already knew that. So until next hour, this is, well,
Fair, balanced,
been the Personal Wealth Coach
Fox
next
News
week.
Radio station in Central Texas, News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.